Today, things just got complicated. Hi again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of those posts covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In this week's market review, in what was actually a very chaotic week, we look at how the financial markets reacted to bad news on inflation and rising target rates from central banks, plus solid earnings from tech megacaps, which, by the way, brought some solace to traders, although worries about recession risks do remain. After Thursday's data showed the US economy contracted in the second quarter, stocks rose as traders bet rates would rise more slowly. But is this a rally within a bear market or the start of a new bull market? I'll give you a clue. Hopium is driving things, not logic. But after an horrific first half, the S&P 500 has had its best month since November 2020, and the Nasdaq 100 had its strongest performance since April of the same year. But this could come to haunt the Federal Open Market Committee, because US financial conditions are looser than they were when the Fed hiked in March. So the spike raises the question of when the rebound itself starts to work against the goal of draining bloat from the economy. It's an issue investors must weigh in calculating the recovery's staying power. Our view is that earnings for all equity classes likely will peak in 2022 and move lower as the economy weakens, revenue growth stalls and input costs remain elevated, said strategists with Wells Fargo Investment Institute in a note on Thursday. While the Fed may be ambivalent about equities in general, the role of markets in mediating a real-world economic lever, financial conditions, means they can never completely be out of mind. Right now, those conditions are loosening in proportion to the S&P 500 gains, so this could be a concern for Powell. He said on Wednesday that policymakers will be monitoring whether financial conditions, a cross-asset measure of market stress, are, quote, appropriately tight. But in the days since the central bank's second straight 75 basis point hike, the measure is now at a level looser than before the first rate hike in March. They don't want easier financial conditions because they want lower demand, bespoke investment group global macro strategist George Perks said. Basically, markets are assuming we've hit peak hawkishness and will be easing sooner than expected. I'm skeptical, he said. The Fed is going to endorse that. The S&P 500 soared 4.3% for the week and 9.1% in July. That's the best monthly advance since November 2020. And its gains snowballed after Powell raised rates 0.75 percentage point and suggested the pace of hikes might slow later this year. Nearly 4% jump on Wednesday and Thursday alone was the biggest two-day gain in record following Fed tightening. The risk on impulse spread to corporate bonds, with both investment grade and high yield spreads narrowing from peaks earlier in the month as traders trimmed wagers on an ultra-aggressive Fed. Treasury yields dropped across the curve as well, with the 10-year Treasury yield dropping to 2.658% after reaching 3.5% in June, but the 10-2 is still inverted, with the 2-year at 2.8905. Taken together, the equity and bond rallies helped loosen US financial conditions, which clocked in at minus 0.46 compared to minus 0.79 reading back in March. The easing of that key metric could be setting up a disappointment for traders who have gone all in on the idea of a friendlier Fed. If the Fed's goal by raising interest rates is to slow the economy by tightening financial conditions, then that hasn't happened since they started to get more serious about rate hikes, said Brian Nick, chief investment strategist at Nuveen. I'm afraid we're in for another instance of what's become very familiar, which is the Fed has to bring the party to a halt at its next meeting or before that. That fear, though, isn't reflected in market pricing. Swaps show that traders expect the Fed funds rate to peak around 3.3% before the end of 2022, less than a percentage point above its current level. At one point in recent months, that level was approaching 4%. While the Fed would likely prefer to see continued tightening, conditions have still compressed significantly in recent months, said iCapital's Anastasia Amoroso. Financial conditions have tightened a whole lot since the beginning of the year, the chief investment strategist at iCapital said. The fact that credit spreads have been tighter, the fact that equity prices have been lower, the fact that rates across the curve have been much higher, this is going to exert still downward pressure on the economy in the coming months. Now, on Friday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 0.97% to 32,846. The S&P 500 gained about 1.42% to 4,130, and the Nasdaq Composite added 1.88% to 12,390. Tech led gains, with Amazon and Apple soaring as higher revenues from the pair of iconic powerhouses countered fears about a profit slowdown at a time when the industry is rethinking its staffing needs. Amazon rallied 10% after reporting quarterly results that beat on the top but missed on the bottom line after taking a $3.9 billion hit from losses in its stake investment in electric vehicle maker Rivian Automotive. Apple, meanwhile, was up more than 3% after quarterly results topped estimates, supported by strength in the iPhone demand, even as supply chain and China lockdown issues weighed on growth. Semiconductor stocks, however, weighed on the broader sector, pressurized by an 8% slump in Intel after the chipmaker cut its guidance after delivering its worst quarterly revenue drop in more than a decade. Despite worrisome signals from economic proxies like Walmart and United Parcel Service, the earnings season as a whole has turned out to be brighter than expected, with about 75% of the S&P 500 firms that have reported results beating analyst estimates. The fact that we have priced in a whole lot of slowdown already, that too has just de-risked the landscape. And so I think that what could happen for the next couple of weeks is that the technical momentum really keeps moving stocks higher while we wait for the next Fed move or the next inflation print. Energy rallied more than 4% as oil majors racked up gains after reporting better than expected results. Rising oil prices also supported sentiment on energy stocks on bets that major oil producers are unlikely to decide to boost output when they meet next week. Two key US price gauges posted larger than forecast increases, with the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, which forms the basis for the Federal Reserve's inflation target, climbing at the fastest pace since 2005. Still, US labor costs increased strongly in the second quarter as a tight jobs market continues to boost wage growth, which could keep inflation elevated. Consumers' long-term inflation expectations also remained elevated, and swaps showed traders increased bets on a 75 basis point hike in September, though they continue to wager that a 50 basis point hike was the most likely outcome. Data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis showed that the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, which the Federal Reserve uses for its inflation target, rose 1% from a month earlier and was up 6.8% since June 2021. The annual advance was the biggest in 40 years, which flags the risk of higher for longer inflation and could undermine the Fed's dovish tone. In fact, US consumer spending barely rose in June after falling in the prior month, underscoring how decades high inflation has eroded Americans' paychecks and tempered demand. Purchases of goods and services, adjusted for changes in prices, increased 0.1% in June after a revised 0.3% drop a month earlier, while spending on services and merchandise both crept higher. Excluding food and energy, the price index increased a larger than forecast 0.6%. That was the biggest gain in more than a year. And the core measure was up 4.8% from a year ago, a slight acceleration from the previous month. Fed Bank of Atlanta President Raphael Bostic noted the US economy was a ways from entering a recession, and officials have further to go in raising rates to get prices under control. And Fed Governor Christopher Waller pushed back against economists Olivia Blanchard and Lawrence Summers, who said the central bank's assertion that it can cool off labor demand without too much impact on the unemployment rate flies in the face of evidence. Despite the big rebound in stocks this month, several market watchers are skeptical about a sustained rally due to the many economic challenges and the fact that the market hasn't gotten cheap enough to call it a bottom. This is a rally within a bear market rather than the start of a new bull market, said David Donabian, Chief Investment Officer at CIBC Private Wealth. We would expect a lower price-earnings ratio if we were at the bottom of the market. While the equity market has partially recovered, we expect it will retest the lows we saw in June. And he said optimism about the Fed potentially wrapping up its tightening cycle earlier than expected is more hope than reality. He sees further rate hikes and says there's still a lot of work ahead to bring down inflation, while adding that a slowing jobs market is on the way. In other corporate news, Intel, the biggest maker of computer processors, slashed forecasts for the year. And Roku, the maker of streaming TV devices, said advertisers were pulling back on spending due to economic concerns. The stock fell 23% after the streaming device company painted a gloomy picture ahead after flagging a slowdown in ad spending and a weaker economic backdrop that will likely dent demand. Despite the positive end to the month for stocks, Mark Hathaway, Chief Investment Officer at UBS Global Wealth Management, said investors should proceed with caution, noting, in the near term, we think the risk-reward for broad equity indices will be muted. Equities are pricing in a soft landing, yet the risk of a deeper slump in economic activity is elevated. The US dollar rebounded from a three-week low in choppy trading on Friday, as the round of US economic data suggested more inflation and higher interest rates. The dollar was last down about 0.3% against a basket of its major peers, still on course for a second month of gains. Futures markets are now predicting that the US interest rate will peak in December this year rather than June 2023, and the Federal Reserve will cut interest rates by nearly 50 basis points next year to support slowing growth. Strong hiring and falling GDP means an unsustainable collapse in productivity. The labour market should slow quickly soon, said Bank of America economists Ethan Harris and Anita Bahar, as they wrote in a note on Friday. The Fed is likely to respond slowly to a recession. We think market optimism about a dovish Fed pivot is premature. Across commodities, Brent crude futures rose about 2.6%, while US West Texas Intermediate crude extended early gains, up 1.95%, as concerns about supply shortages ahead of the next meeting of OPEC ministers offset doubts around the economic outlook. The members have now unwound the record 9.7 million barrels per day supply cut they agreed to in April 2020 when the COVID-19 pandemic slammed demand. It could be difficult for the group to boost supply significantly given that many members are struggling to meet their current production quotas due to a lack of investment. Spot gold gained around 0.78% to 1,764. That's a three-week high supported by a softer dollar and bets that the Federal Reserve may cool the pace of rate hikes as economic risks deepen. US gross domestic product fell 0.9% in the second quarter, the Bureau of Economic Analysis reported, and the slide is real inflation-adjusted output calculated at an annual rate. And that follows a 1.6% decline in quarter one. The back-to-back decreases immediately triggered calls that the US is in recession, but there's also pushback from some analysts advising that there's room for debate. The militant wing of recessionists quickly cried foul, and in the blink of an eye, both sides were attacking the other as delusional. In fact, both sides are right and sort of wrong. Some pundits would have you believe that there's a conspiracy afoot in claiming that the two back-to-back negative GDP quarters is not the first and last definition of recession, but it only appears accurate if your attention span on business cycle analytics extends to no further than, say, the past 24 hours. The National Bureau of Economic Research, the NBER, is the body that officially dates the start and end dates for US recessions and expansions, and it's long explained that its process is more than waiting for two GDP prints to announce contraction. If you're just discovering this now, you haven't been paying attention. And let's be fair, most folks don't pay attention probably because business cycle analytics is a low-stakes task most of the time. In any case, NBER makes no secret of its process. The group advises that the determination of the months of peaks and troughs is based on a range of monthly measures of aggregate real economic activity published by the federal statistical agencies. This strikes some as a shocking disclosure, evidence of some deep-seated plot to mislead the public. And in some of the more extreme charges, it's all about helping the current occupant of the White House bolster his sagging opinions. Well, we'll see. The truth is far more benign and probably banal. It starts with the reality that the NBER's recession dating definitions have always been fuzzy, and this has always sparked debate, but as a relatively quiet economic econometric discussion. If you think about this debate for 30 seconds, you realise that if all that's required to call a recession is to wait for the GDP to decline for two straight quarters, there will be no point in the MBER. The bigger question, though, is whether there's a case for a more nuanced definition of recession. Well, possibly. Without going down the rabbit hole, let's simply note that for all the relevance and use of GDP, it's a flawed metric that only partially captures the full ebb and flow of the economy. This is old news, of course. There's long been a cottage industry of critics arguing that GDP is a poor measure of economic activity. But the demand for one all-encompassing number remains in high demand for good or ill, and of course it goes all over the social media. The point here is that the MBR's efforts in business cycle dating are an attempt to go beyond GDP simplicity by developing a more robust methodology for calling recessions and expansions. And yes, the group does a great job. No credible economist claims that MBR's recessions and expansion dates are wrong. So simply put, you could say that the MBR is the gold standard. But the problem is that the MBR's rules are fuzzy and its pronouncements arrive with a significant lag. That arguably is the price for issuing business cycle dates that are never revised and widely, if not universally, accepted as fact. But that leaves a research hole timely, reliable estimates of recession and expansion start and end dates. So welcome to the wild west of business cycle analytics, at least to what's become a popular rough estimate. Two quarterly GDP declines. Yes, it's a decent, if blunt, tool, and you could do a lot worse. So why not just be done with it and embrace the two quarters rule as evidence that a recession has started? Well, there are several reasons. First, the latest GDP report will be revised. It's actually several times. And so the clarity that it seems to offer at the moment may become less so in the months ahead. And that's the problem, of course. Real-time analytics is a bit of a bitch versus the calm and clear realm of using vintage data to state what's happened in history. More importantly, there are a number of other economics indicators and business cycle benchmarks that don't yet show a clear cycle that a recession has started, including the Philly Fed's ADS index and the New York Fed's weekly economic index. We can't dismiss the possibility that the recession has arrived, but there's still a case for debate, and that debate will give way to something approximating full clarity in the weeks and months ahead. But for some folks, simply saying so is evidence of an evil scheme to hoodwink the masses. Fortunately, there's an alternative and accurate interpretation. The data leaves room for doubt. Now, there are some similarities to the 1998 dot-com bubble, though, at the moment in the current US markets. First is the rise in CPI and the huge increase in inflation. CPI continued to rise throughout 1998 to 2008, all through the dot-com bubble disruption and up to the peak in 2007. The same type of thing is happening in CPI right now. So that's a reason why possibly the Fed will continue to aggressively raise rates, because the US inflation is red hot and the past few rate increases have done little to disrupt US economic trends. Yes, housing, retail sales and manufacturing are starting to see a shift in demand and activity, but the Fed is trapped in a very difficult situation where it must attempt to unwind the capital excesses throughout the world by adjusting rates and capacity in the US. That means the global markets will react to what the Fed is doing and attempt to chase opportunities in a stronger US dollar until the Fed is able to break the cycle. In fact, the pound and Japanese yen are already at a combined lowest ratio level compared to the US dollar over the past 25 years. So you can think about the intense economic valuation pressures that are stressing many foreign global economies and currencies as the US dollar continues to strengthen. Debts, liabilities, ongoing expenditures and essential services all need to continue for the people affected. And 40% of global trade is in US dollars. It may be just a matter of time before bigger cracks start to appear. We may see more risings and riots as we saw recently in Sri Lanka. We may see additional regional economic collapse events, even as rich nations strain to maintain debt liabilities. We'll probably see various aggressions ramp up as currency valuations get pushed towards the extremes. So you should expect the currency wars to begin, and the Fed must continue to try to break US inflation. To do that, it may have to break multiple foreign currency capital functions and push global capital functions from one extreme, speculation, to another, contraction. Now, over in Europe, markets opened higher on Friday ahead of the latest inflation data. The Eurozone inflation came in and climbed to another all-time high, supporting calls for the European Central Bank to follow up on its first interest rate hike since 2011 with another big move. Consumer prices jumped 8.9% from a year earlier in July. That's up from 8.6% last month and driven once again by soaring energy and food costs. The number was a little higher than expected by economists. After slowing in June, the gauge of underlying inflation that excludes energy and food also hit a record of 4%. At the close, the pan-European Stock 600 rose 1.28% to 438.30, moving towards its best monthly performance since November 2020. The DAX in Germany trailed that 1.52% to 13,484. The CAC 40 in France increased 1.72% to 6,448, while the FTSE 100 in London was up 1.06% to 7,423. Economists are calling for GDP to rise 0.2% of the quarter, a slowdown from the 0.6% quarterly growth in the first three-month period. But French GDP rose 0.5% of the quarter ahead of the 0.2% growth expected. But there will still be a risk to the downside, with European Central Bank Governing Council members warning on Thursday that there was a risk of a recession in the region. Renault recorded a $1.39 billion net loss in the first half of the year from the costs of closing its Russian business, but the French carmaker upgraded its full-year outlook because of improving profitability elsewhere. Shares in the company jumped almost 6%, that's nearing the top of the Stock 600. Meanwhile, Air France shares zoomed up by almost 7%, despite the airline downgrading its capacity forecast for the third quarter due to operational difficulties at airports. And the French bank BNP Paribas reported better than expected profits in the second quarter, lifting shares in the green as bad loan provisions dipped despite the economic slowdown. And Standard Chartered PLC shares rose more than 3% after first half pre-tax profits rose 19%. That's above market expectations. The emerging market focused lender benefited from rising interest rates and they gave an upbeat outlook. Now in the Asian Pacific area, Asia-Pacific stocks were mixed on Friday morning after US equities rose on earnings, but a decline in Hong Kong and hesitant performance in China hampered Chinese equities. At the close, Japan's Nikkei 225 slid 0.05% to 27,801. South Korea's Kospi jumped 0.67% to 2,451, while Hong Kong's Hang Seng was down 2.26% to 20,156. And China's Shanghai Composite was down 0.58% to 3,253. Now, it's interesting that China did not mention its full-year GDP growth target after a high-level Communist Party meeting, suggesting the target may prove hard to hit as the country continues to struggle with COVID-19 outbreaks and lockdowns. But Chinese property is in the eye of the storm. And within the storm, China Evergrande Group, the world's most indebted developer, is at the epicenter of a broader debt crisis in the country's property industry. The beleaguered property giant made an exchange filing in Hong Kong late on the night of the final business day of the month, and it presented just preliminary restructuring principles rather than the promised specific restructuring plan. Evergrande's failure to deliver on its preliminary plan could fuel concerns about the future of a firm whose fate has broad implications for China's $50 trillion financial system and millions of homeowners. Other builders have added to record defaults since last year after a government crackdown on excessive leverage and speculation on housing. Liquidity crunches have prompted developers to stall projects and leave fees unpaid. Unprecedented mortgage and loan boycotts have erupted from angry home buyers and suppliers. The sheer size of Evergrande's liabilities of around $300 billion has left global investors worried that any collapse could spark financial contagion and curb growth in the world's second largest economy, which depends on the housing market for about a quarter of gross domestic product. The whole pyramid is collapsing now, said Anne Stevenson Yang, co-founder of J Capital Research. What's different is that things are worse now because of the Evergrande crisis a year ago, which is spreading its tentacles throughout the Chinese economy. Newly appointed Chief Executive Officer Sean Xiu said that Evergrande will focus on completing construction projects and won't sacrifice the interests of onshore investors, according to a recent interview. When asked why the restructuring plan fell short of market expectations, he said that the company encountered complicated and challenging matters, asking for more patience. The delay is not exactly a surprise to the market, given that there was the negative development at Evergrande recently about the resignation of the CEO and the CFO, said Zerling Zeng, senior credit analysis from credit sites. The company itself said as recently as June that it was actively pushing forward with restructuring work and expected to announce the preliminary plan by the end of July. The builder shook markets when it defaulted on dollar bond payments late last year. It's also facing a winding up lawsuit and resistance from creditors that could push it towards its first onshore default. Evergrande said on Friday that it may offer some assets outside of China to repay creditors, including shares in the electric vehicle and property management services. And the restructuring will also include companies' offshore notes, debt obligations to its subsidiaries, and repurchase obligations by its unlisted online sales platform, FCB Group, it said. And the builder said the principle of fair treatment of creditors will be reflected in the restructuring proposal. President Xi Jinping's government is trying to strike a balance between curbing debt at acquisitive and leveraged private companies while limiting the economic fallout. Xi is seeking to rein in ballooning borrowings and the billionaire class as part of his common prosperity campaign to reduce a yawning wealth gap. That's led to a record wave of dollar bond defaults by developers. One example of how this is all cascading: a group of small businesses and suppliers that said they'd stop paying their own debts blamed Evergrande for leaving them out of pocket. China is considering a plan to seize undeveloped land from distressed real estate companies and using it to help finance the completion of stalled housing projects that have sparked mortgage boycotts across the country. The proposal, which is still under discussion and could change, would take advantage of Chinese laws, allowing local governments to wrest back control of land sold to real estate companies if it remains undeveloped after 2 years without compensation. That would give authorities more leeway to direct funds towards uncompleted homes, potentially to the detriment of creditors who would lose claims on some of the developer's most valuable assets. The proposal is one of several measures under consideration as Xi Jinping's government tries to prevent turmoil in the housing market from fueling social unrest and derailing the broader economy. The focus on completing projects is the latest sign that policymakers are prioritising homeowners over bondholders who have been burned by a record number of defaults by real estate giants, including China Evergrande. The Ministry of Housing and Urban and Rural Developments is discussing the proposals with other regulators, and it's unclear whether it will get a green light from senior Chinese leaders. China's top 100 developers own land parcels valued around 42.5 trillion yuan, or $6.3 trillion, at the end of last year, according to China Real Estate Information Co-op. Many of them borrowed heavily to buy the land in hopes that prices would continue to rise. That bet is now souring after a multi-year government clampdown on real estate leverage that has weighed on home prices, land values, and new residential property sales. The result is that many distressed builders are sitting on land they've been unable or unwilling to develop, and just 37% of land parcels auctioned in the first batch of centralized land bidding last year have started work as of March, according to a recent Caxin report. About 16% of the second batch were being developed, the newspaper said. Now, in Australia, blue chips gained further ground on Friday, helped by a turn in investor appetite for risks and a growing belief that central banks will have to taper monetary tightening if large economies slow too quickly. The ASX 200 rose 0.81% to 6,945, and the broader S&P All Ordinaries added 0.78% to close at 7,173. The advance brings the S&P ASX 200 benchmark 2.2% higher for the week, compounding the 2.8% surge in the prior week. That's the best since March. The blue chip benchmark now sits 8% higher than the lowest point of the year, achieved, of course, back in mid-June, and reduces to 6.7% the decline since the year began. Sectors that trade in line with the bond market broadly fared best on Friday, mirroring a rally in government bonds, and real estate shares traded 3% higher, followed by utilities, which added 2.5%. The materials sector, the second largest by value, rose 1%, while financials, which as the largest sector accounts for a third of the index, traded 0.6% higher. Healthcare was the day's laggard, and the only share market sector to notch a negative day, inching 0.06% lower. Shares in Origin Energy added 4.2% to $5.94, the highest level since June, after the company disclosed a doubling in revenue from its holdings in the Australian Pacific LNG projects in the year ended June 30. The shares have gained 11% this year, helped along by the soaring level of commodity prices around the world. Shares in PolyNovo, the burns treatment specialist, jumped 8.6% to $1.64 after the company said Swami Reitu will take the reins as CEO, effective immediately succeeding Max Johnson, who has been acting as chief executive officer since November. Mr. Reitu spent 3 decades at pharmaceutical giant Johnson & Johnson as a transformation growth leader in several areas, including its drugs business and medical devices. St. Barbara, the gold miner, led among blue chips with a 9.8% advance to $1.13. Shares in Zip, the payments company, fell more than any other blue chip and shed a quarter of their value to close at $1.14, capping a week of seesawing trade. And shares in Sezzle, a smaller rival, had also whipsawed during the week and lost a fifth of their value to close at 82 cents after initially trading higher during the session after the company declared it would be profitable by Christmas. Among the banks, CBA rose 0.88% to $100.77, NAB rose 0.89% to $30.60, ANZ rose 0.88% to $22.99, and Westpac was up just 0.37% to $21.50. Macquarie was up 1.25% to $181.13. The Aussie dollar was pretty flat at 69.87, reacting to the strength in the US dollar. And finally, in crypto, Bitcoin is loving the shift from the Fed towards potentially slowing the pace of rate hikes into year-end. It's been a painful year for cryptos, and they may be in for some relief if the language from the Fed continues to support lower increases going forward. Whether the recovery has legs, though, over the medium term, very much depends on how quickly inflation softens and whether the crypto news flow improves. A recovery in price could certainly help that. Bitcoin was at 23,854 and Ethereum was at 1,711. But if you stand back, you can see just how much things are very much in play here. And whilst at one end of the spectrum, the markets are reacting to positive news on the results side, the truth is that this is a bear rally. It will run out of smoke quite soon because the fundamentals, those long-term issues, are still there. Inflation is still going to be higher than is needed and wanted. And the very important point about markets bouncing, creating more headroom pressure for the Fed, is exactly spot on. So my view is we'll go up a little bit, but then there'll be a further leg down, probably September, October, and then we'll see where we are then. This is not the end of the old story. It's not even the beginning of a new story. It is, unfortunately, a continuation of the same old. And just remember this, a lot of the inflation that's been created was created by bad central bank intervention and liquidity over 20 years. Will they really wean themselves off that? That, of course, becomes the big question of the day. And if the answer is yes, they are really serious about weaning that off and reducing their support, markets have a long, long way to go yet. So hang on to your hats, and maybe if you're thinking of relieving some of the exposures that you've got, this little peak in the rally at the moment could be a reasonable time to do it. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.